Yet even as he asks it, he knows the reasons why. He is doing it precisely because it is pointless and foolish and out of character. He is doing it because it is the kind of thing he would never, ever do. Because the kind of thing he does do, following the rules, working hard, being good, like a boy ordered from a catalogue, has lately come to seem quite empty. It might have something to do with Dad getting Mr. Fallon fired, even when Jeekers begged him not to. Or maybe the creeping realization that it was the best boy that Dad loved, not Jeekers, and that if he was kidnapped and the best boy left in his place, Dad would not be sad. Anyway, here he is. And as he looks across the stage, at the other three primed over their instruments, Jeff's triangle lilting ever so slightly back and forth, like a leaf in anticipation of a breeze, Dennis's smirk just visible at the mouthpiece to his bassoon, Ruprecht breathing very slowly, focus fixed on the back of the auditorium, on his lap the mangled horn that Jeekers still can't look at without setting off an interior pandemonium of alarm. And then at Father Lawton, poor, unsuspecting Father Lawton, as he raises his baton. The weird thing is, even though he knows Ruprecht is wrong and there is no chance of this working, still, at this precise moment in time, beneath the bright lights, shaking with nerves, surrounded by parents and priests in the sports hall on a Saturday night, reality does feel distinctly unreal, and what seemed unreal, conversely, feels a lot closer than before. And the music, when it begins, sounds so beautiful. Pachelbel's familiar melody, worn threadbare by endless TV commercials for cars, life assurance, luxury soap, by street performers in black tie, mugging for tourists in high summer, by any number of attempts to invoke old-world elegance, accompanied by haughty waiters bearing trayfuls of tiny cubes of cheese. Tonight it seems to its audience entirely new, to the point of an almost painful fragility. What is it that makes it so imploring and so sweet, so disconcertingly, for the older members of the audience who have come tonight expecting merely to be pleasantly bored and now find themselves with lumps in their throats? Personal. Something to do with the horn that large boy in the silver suit is playing, perhaps. A new-fangled instrument that looks like it must have been run over by a truck, but produces a sound that's like nothing you've ever heard. A hoarse, forlorn sound that just makes you want to... And then the voice comes in, and you can actually see a shiver run through the decorous crowd. Because there is no singer on the stage, and given that Pachelbel's canon does not have a vocal part, listeners could be forgiven for mistaking it for a ghost's, some spirit of the hall roused by the music's beauty and unable to resist joining in, especially as the voice, a girl's, has an irresistibly haunting quality, spare, spectral, carved down to its bare bones. But then, one by one, the audience members spot beneath the mic stand, over to the right, ah, an ordinary mobile phone. But who is she, and what's she singing?
You fizz me up like Diet Pepsi. You make me shake like epilepsy. You held my hand all summer long, but summer's over and you're gone.
Holy smokes! It's Bethany! A new murmur of excitement as younger spectators crane their necks to hiss in the ears of parents, aunts, uncles. It's Three Wishes, the song she wrote after she broke up with Nick from Four to the Floor, when there were all those pictures of her at her mum's, wearing skanky clothes and actually looking quite fat. Some people said that was all just part of the publicity. But how could you think that if you listened to the words?
I miss the bus and the walk so long. I got split ends and my homework's wrong. There's a hole in my sneaker and gum on my seat. And the world don't turn and my heart don't beat.
which the girl who's singing now fills with such longing, such loneliness, only amplified by the crackling of the phone, that even parents who view Bethany with suspicion or disapproval, often coloured in the case of the dads by a shameful fascination, find themselves swept up by its sentiments. Sentiments that, separated from their R&B arrangement, and grafted onto this melancholy, spiralling music, 300 years old, reveal themselves as both heart-rending and also somehow comforting. Because their sadness is a sadness everyone can recognise, a sadness that is binding and homelike.
And the sun don't shine, and the rain don't rain, and the dogs don't bark, and the lights don't change, and the night don't fall, and the birds don't sing, and your door don't open, and my phone don't ring.
So that as the chorus comes around once more, you can hear young voices emerge from the darkness, singing along.
I wish you were beside me just so I could let you know. I wish you were beside me, I would never let you go. If I had three wishes, I would give away two, 'cause I only need one, 'cause I only want you.
So that for these few moments, it actually seems that Ruprecht could be right, that everything, or at least the small corner of everything that is the Seabrook Sports Hall, is resonating to the same chord, the same feeling, the one that over a lifetime you learn a million ways to camouflage, but never quite to banish. The feeling of living in a world of apartness, of distances you cannot overcome. It's almost as if the strange, out-of-nowhere voice is the universe itself. Some hidden aspect of it that rises momentarily over the motorway roar of space and time to console you, to remind you that, although you can't overcome the distances, you can still sing the song, out into the darkness, over the separating voids, towards a fleeting moment of harmony. And then, just as manly hands throughout the hall move clandestinely to brush away rogue tears, something happens. At first, it's hard to detect what it is, other than that it's wrong, very wrong. Heads recoil involuntarily. A spasm of distress flickers across Father Lawton's cheek, as at some transcendental toothache. It's the song. It appears to have somehow bifurcated. That is to say, it continues on as it was, but also, and at the same time, in a different key. The result is viscerally, nails across a blackboard, ugly. But the musicians do not seem to have noticed, and continue not to notice as the song does it again, so that there are now three versions playing at once, in different keys, and then another, and another, like parallel universe canons, somehow gathered into the same auditorium, getting louder all the while. Wildly, you look to either side of you, wondering if you're going mad, because this surely is what madness must sound like. Everywhere, you see hands pressed to ears, faces shriveled up like snails retreating into their shells. Now as the layers mount on top of one another, some super-song begins to loom above them, a song of all possible songs, something not so much heard as felt, like the awful, oppressive, atmospheric weight preceding a storm or other impending catastrophe. The volume soars. Still Ruprecht et al. Play on impassively. The engineer at the sound desk regards his levels in horror. And now the automator staggers out from the wings and into the waves of ineluctable noise, which has now achieved the status of unthinkable, impossible, no longer remotely discernible as a song. He lurches over the stage, like a man in a hurricane, only to be assailed, just as he reaches Ruprecht, by a peal of sonic energy that is like nothing on earth. Howard had driven to Seabrook at full tilt. His hand, bound clumsily in a huge, swollen mitten of linen bandage, screaming every time he had to change gears or apply the brake, making him scream along with it, without knowing quite what he would do when he got there. The vague plan he had in his mind, of unmasking the coach in front of a gasping audience, followed by a Hollywood-style punch-up, Howard and Tom mano a mano, had, he knew, some serious holes. How could he fight with an injured hand? How could he fight a disabled man? Still, for the moment he preferred to leave these to one side, instead racing ahead to the aftermath, in which he arrived at Hallie's door, bruised and bloody from his encounter, but, as she would recognize instantly, inwardly restored. She would quieten his burbled apologies with a finger to the lips. She would smile that smile he had missed so much, so bright and strong, like a kinder, warmer cousin of light, and take him by his good hand inside to her bed. All these fantasies had been summarily squashed by the automator. Ever since, Howard has been in the ferry, trying to stoke up the remnants of his anger. He hit me. The fucker actually hit me. Sufficiently that he can... That he can what? Take the coach behind the swimming pool and teach him a lesson? Like they were both 14 years old? And then everything would be peachy? The world restored? Too late. Reality has indelibly set in again. So he abandons his plans and just drinks. The pain in his hand provides an excellent excuse. It is excruciating, and has extended itself to colonize his entire body. Everything pounds at him, like clumsy fingers on a piano. The laughter and grumbling of the other drinkers. The beauty of the beautiful lounge girl. The hideous carpet. The miasma of body odor. And now a familiar houndstooth jacket.
Ah, Howard, wasn't expecting to find you here.
Jim Slattery pulls up a stool, motions to the lounge girl.
Mind if I...
Howard makes an indifferent gesture with his good hand.
Didn't make it to the concert?
Sold out.
Yes, indeed, even those of us with tickets. That is to say, there was a group of late arrivals from KPMG. Greg asked me if I wouldn't mind. Didn't bother me, of course, especially if it gives me the chance of a snifter without herself being any the wiser. Cheers.
The clink of glass causes Howard to wince, and the wince to set off a chain of small agonies.
Good Lord, what happened to your hand?
Caught it in a mousetrap,
is the tight reply.
Oh,
Slattery says equanimously. He sips at his drink, swirls it around his mouth.
I heard you'd been in the wars lately, that is to say, not just with the mice.
Rodents of one kind or another.
Howard says. Then reflecting, he adds glumly.
Mostly brought it on myself, though.
Oh, well. Things will come round, I'm sure.
Howard merely grunts at this. The older man clears his throat and changes the subject.
You know, I came across something the other day that made me think of you. An essay by Robert Graves, Mammon and the Black Goddess.
Ah, Graves.
Howard, who feels that the poet has something to answer for in his present situation, smiles sardonically.
Whatever happened to old Graves?
Well, I dare say you know most of the story. Married after the war, moved to Wales, tried to live the domestic life. Didn't last long, as you can imagine. He got himself mixed up with a poetess, an American named Laura Riding, and took off with her to Mallorca, where they set up shop with her as his muse. She was as mad as a hatter, by all accounts. Ran away with an Irishman named Phibbs, if I recall.
Some muse,
Howard remarks bitterly.
As a matter of fact, that fitted Graves' conception of things pretty neatly. The muse is an embodiment of the white goddess, you see. If she settles down with you and starts a home, then she loses her powers, becomes merely a woman, so to speak. Which means no more poetry, which in Graves' eyes was almost as bad as death. If she deserts you, on the other hand, then you find another muse to inspire you, and the whole circus starts all over again.
Makes you wonder why you'd even bother.
There must have been an element of self-punishment to it, I think. Graves had always suffered tremendous guilt over his part in the war, the men he'd killed and seen killed. And then, you see, his son died. His son David was killed in Burma in the Second World War. Graves had encouraged him to sign up and helped him to get into the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, his old regiment. It was directly after the death of his son that he started writing about the White Goddess, all this business about suffering and sacrifice, in the name of poetry, trying to make sense of it all in his own barmy way.